Who are you?
Who am I? Who is this beast?
You are Mike Edson. Edson or Edison?
Edison.
Edison, as in the Edison.
Goddamn. Yeah, well, I'm not related. And here in New York City, the power company is called Con Edison, Consolidated Edison, and I don't even get a discount. Yeah, I'm Mike Edison, and from New York City, and I wrote that kooky book, I Have Fun Everywhere I Go, Savage Tales of Pot, Porn, Punk Rock, Pro Wrestling, Talking Apes, Evil Bosses, Dirty Blues, and a bunch of other stuff I can barely even remember. We made that kooky spoken word rock and roll record with my friend John Spencer, and I'm here to tell you all about it.
The word kooky, I view that as a compliment. Do some people not like the word kooky? Do people call you kooky? Like, to be called kooky, to me, is like, kooky, kooky, lend me your comb. It's like the coolest thing in the world.
Well, I don't know if anybody's called me kooky. I get called a lot of things. But, yeah, it's a good word. It's one of my favorites. I don't know. I like kooky, icky, yucky. These are words I like.
Now, that song, Kooky, Kooky, Lend Me Your Comb, that's a classic from, like, Goofy Greats, one of those great K-Tel compilations. And when I think of you, Mike, I think of the Ronchans, the legendary New York slime, sleazeball, gutter rock, pre-proto-punk, and when I say pre-proto-punk, I mean pre-punk explosion of, like, the Hives and all those other types of bands and stuff.
Yeah, you know, the Hives actually cover Ronchan's song. The guys, Mike Chandler and Mike Maracana, the guitar player and singer who wrote Blackjack, I guess the Hives did it on the first record, still getting checks from those boys for it. In fact, we played a couple years ago in Austin. It was the 20th anniversary of the Ronchans, and the Hives were in town. They came down and did it with us. It was very nice. Nice guys, those Hives.
They give total respect. Respect is due. Like, they mentioned they love the Devil Dogs, too, and stuff like that, and how they got their look from some of the Devil Dogs outfits, a legendary band. The Devil Dogs wore on stage, or speaking here, too. Legendary Mike Edison, author of an amazing book called...
I Have Fun Everywhere I Go.
Tales of...
Pot, porn, punk rock, pro wrestling, talking apes, dirty blues, evil bosses, and the most notorious magazines in the world.
Now, Mike, you taught me through the Ronchans, although you weren't in the band at the time, although I'm sure you played the song, you taught me about Murray Wilson, I Live for the Sun, The Sunrays. The Ronchans covered I Live for the Sun by the band The Sunrays. What can you tell the people about The Sunrays and Murray Wilson, Brian Wilson's dad?
I don't know too much about the history of that song, except that when we attacked, it sounds more like the Sex Pistols than the Sunrays.
It's a great tune that you guys cover. It's by the Sunrays, who is Murray Wilson's pet project. I guess after he ditched Brian Wilson, he got a new band that would actually do what he told them to do, and that was the Sunrays. And then the Ronchans bring back that song. And when I heard the Sunrays for the first time, I'm like, I heard this before through the Ronchans. Like, your bands that you've been in have really educated the kids with lots.
Yeah, you know, that's the strange thing about the Ronchans is our crowds are always split between people who really came to just rock out and get sleazy with us and drink with us and snort and smoke, and then the record collecting geeks who are like watching our every move, trying to steal riffs and figure out what we had hidden in our record collections. Yeah, but, our job, I always said, was to rock, not to educate. And if we were learning some kids in the process, that's cool.
What was that time like, Mike, with, like, the Chesterfield Kings and the Fuzz Tones around? I've seen, looking through early discographies and gig mentions, that, like, the Chesterfield Kings played with Bo Diddley. The Fuzz Tones did stuff with Screaming Jay Hawkins. And this seemed to be when Bo Diddley and Screaming Jay Hawkins weren't as popular as they are now, unfortunately, both now dearly departed. What was that time like with the Chesterfield Kings and the Fuzz Tones? Did you ever play with the Chesterfield Kings or the Fuzz Tones? I imagine you probably did in the Ronchans, right?
Yeah, of course. We played with all those guys and lots more like them. We've seen them come and we've seen them go. And the Ronchans are still playing. We're off to Europe next month to do some gigs. Every once in a while, we can shake it up. I got to tell you, Bo Diddley was never any good live. And Screamin' Jay Hawkins was pretty much at the end of his career, too, at that time. So... for two guys who made amazingly good records and were hugely influential in all of us, it was kind of like grave robbing at that point. You know what I'm saying?
Did they tell good stories, though? Did you get a chance to speak to Bo or Screaming Jay?
Screaming Jay Hawkins had some stories. He had like 25 kids. And
it was like 69 kids or something.
Yeah.
They even have a website where you can track down to see if you're related to Screaming Jay.
Yeah, he was a crazy old badass guy. And Bo was kind of square. He was never really around. Bo was always on the stay in school, don't take drugs tip, you know, which is not really my philosophy.
At that same time, was little Steven crawling around? Because now he's totally big time aboard the Garage Rock Empire. Do you remember little Steven back then? Because he's organized all these great sort of revival gigs that he's put together.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that sort of cuts both ways. I mean, rah-rah for him for getting involved in the garage rock scene, you know, maybe 15 or 20 years after it was really cranking out. And I suppose we should, you know, mention, you know, Lux Interior died this week, which was a huge blow to all of us, you know. I mean, that, you want to ask what was happening, like, when we all started out? I'll tell you what was happening. The Cramps were happening. They were the coolest band, and we all were in awe of them. You know, I mean, that was it. I mean, there was no question about it. Everyone I knew was just in awe of Lux and Ivy, and we saw them all the time. And one good thing about the Cramps was, you know, all our bands, we were like speed snorting and pot smoking and liquor drinking kind of bands. They were like LSD dropping kind of music, and their shows were like that. It was very weird. They were a lot stranger and a lot more happening in a lot of ways than all of us were. You know?
When is the first time that you saw the Cramps, and did you ever play with the Cramps in the Ron Chans?
The Ron Chans opened up for the Cramps a couple times in New York. The first time, I'll tell you, I remember the first time I heard Human Fly, man. We were like getting hit in the head with a fucking bag of bricks. It was unbelievable.
That's my favorite song ever, by the way. That's why I'm Nardwar, the Human Serviette, in honor of the song Human Fly. I love the Human Fly.
You know, I was like, oh, what's this? This is cool. And that fuzz guitar comes in, and it's like, you know, holy mother of all things, you know, great and good in this world. When that fuzz guitar kicked in, it was like, all music should sound like this. You know, it was just a revelation. I was there the night they did the Smell Female record at the Peppermint Lounge.
Oh, so you met Fur, the bassist, then? I think the bass at that time was Fur, wasn't it?
No, that was before they got a bass player. Let me tell you something. The day they got a bass player was the day I lost interest in the Cramps. I mean, to me, that was just like a lousy idea. That was like the Stooges playing with the Philharmonic. Bad idea. That was like putting chocolate sauce on cocaine. Bad idea. You know, the whole formula of the Cramps. I mean, why change the original recipe? Colonel Sanders, you know, is sticking to his guns. Coke tried to change. It was a disaster. The Cramps, same thing. They got a bass player. All of a sudden, they didn't sound like the Cramps. They sounded like a band playing Cramps songs. You know, the fuzz guitar, to me, was like the ethereal part of it. It was very, very important, the combination of heavy-duty fuzz and wicked twang.
So, Mike Edison, can we actually hear you in the audience at the Smell of Female recording session then?
I wonder. You know, maybe. I haven't listened to it in a while. I'll tell you, that night they did two sets because they were recording, and the first set never seemed to really take off. People were sort of standing around watching them play, and it just seemed like it never really caught. And the second set was incredible, and that was the only night I ever had any really true window pane acid, like a real gel. Because back in the day, I used to be pretty enthusiastic about the psychedelics, and it was always little pieces of paper we were eating. You know, I'm talking about, you know, little blotters with pictures of dolphins and pyramids of the eyes were popular, and stars, and occasionally some Grateful Dead kind of work. But that night we had the true gels, and I think everyone in the audience was on that same windowpane acid. And I think it all kicked in right after the first set, because the second set, people were flying through the air. It was incredible.
It's so sad, too. Lux gone. Like, just when you think about it, Ron from the Stooges, Lux now from the Cramps gone. And it's amazing also to think that Lux was rocking at kind of an older age. Like, it just occurred to me, I guess, when punk hit, he was probably, like, in his 30s. And here he is recently in his 60s, been out there rocking.
Yeah, he's like Mick Jagger old, man. He was always old. He was old back then. I mean, he wasn't a kid. He wasn't one of us. We weren't his peer group. But, yeah, I mean, he was just some, you know, twisted old fruit rocking and rolling. I always liked that the older he got, the weirder and more into, like, cross-dressing he got. I mean, you would think that the guy at the beginning of his career would be wearing PVC G-strings and, like, high heels and then sort of tame it down a little bit. But it went the other way. If you look at him, like, this week I was watching, you know, the videos on YouTube of them playing at the mental institution. He's like wearing, like, you know, a regular old shirt and some jeans, and he's got a little bit of hair spray going on and some kind of crudely applied makeup. And, you know, 30 years later, he's wearing, like, really, like, red patent leather pantsuits and fuck me pumps. You know, looking more like a woman, looking more twisted and weirder than he did at the beginning.
Mike Edison, author of I have fun everywhere I go. Speaking to me, Nardwuar, Human Serviette, live from New York City. When you opened up for the Cramps in your band, the Ronchans, one of your many bands, I should mention that there's other bands, too, that you've been in as well, such as Sharky's Machine.
Yeah, Sharky's Machine. I don't know if anybody knows or cares about Sharky's Machine, but we did make some pretty good noise. If anybody wants to hear all this stuff, you know, back in the day I was playing the drums all the time. These days I'm more like singing and playing guitar. But on my website, rockettrain.com, which is just like it sounds, Rocket Train with two T's, there's a free downloadable CD. It's 12 free tracks, and it's called How Punk Rock Ruined My Life. Volume 1.
And it's got everything from the Ronchans to the Pleasure Fuckers up there.
It's got the Pleasure Fuckers, the Ronchans, G.G. Allen, and Sharky's Machine, and it's all me, like, you know, banging on the drums. And it's good. I'll tell you what, it's real good, because after all those bands, I had about 100 songs to pick from, like, and I picked the best 12, and I'll tell you, if I couldn't pick 12 great songs after, you know, out of 8 records, then, man, I must really suck.
Did you play any live shows with G.G. Allen?
Yeah. I played with Gigi on and off. I started out playing the drums with Gigi and then switched to guitar because I got tired of being a stationary target. You know, if you're dodging bottles, you're having a snare drum between your legs.
How about dodging Gigi's stuff? Did you have to dodge any of Gigi's stuff that may have come out of Gigi?
No, not really. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I hung out with Gigi. We were friends. We were... I really counted him as a friend, a true friend. I don't know how many people he had in his life that were friends and not hangers-on, a handful. I think me, his brother Merle, maybe a few others. But we had a pretty good mutual respect thing going on, and he knew I wasn't going to put up with any of his bullshit like that. I mean, I saw it all, but I was not a target.
I was going to ask you, Mike, about opening for the Cramps, what sort of reaction that the Ronchans got opening for the Cramps, like what the Cramps audience was like when you opened for the Cramps in the 1980s, and I was going to ask you if it got to be hostile, but I guess it can't be too hostile, because if you played with G.G. Allen, nothing must be hostile, right? Was G.G. Allen the most hostile audience that you played for? So if you open for the Cramps and one person is like throwing something, it's no big deal, because the whole night when you're playing with G.G., stuff is going to the stage?
Well, I'll tell you, when we're doing gigs with the Cramps, and then the Ronchans were kind of, you know, we had a hot hand. We were local heroes. We had a lot of friends and fans at the time. That was all good because we were all chasing the same thing, the Cramps and the Ronchans and our friends. That was good. And with Gigi, it was different because you start out with a room full of fans, and it takes about 5 minutes for him to turn his fans into enemies. I mean, you never saw a guy who could antagonize even his greatest fans, and things would start flying, and bottles were flying, and every other damn thing. But the worst audience I ever played with was opening for the Ramones. Sharky's Machine went up to Vassar College, which is in upstate New York, to open for the Ramones, and people were throwing shit from the first note because they weren't really punk rock fans. They didn't really have open ears. They came to see the Ramones, and they thought the punk rock, they were college kids. They were frat boy jerk-offs, you know, and they thought the best thing to do to try to be punk was to boo the opening band. That's a tough gig, opening for the Ramones.
Do you think if you were called Killdozer at that time, it would have helped, like you were called Killdozer before the other band was called Killdozer, right?
Man, you know everything. Yeah, I don't like talking about that too much. That was just some bad goddamn luck. I started the band, we called it Killdozer, which is from this really bad made-for-TV movie about aliens invading a construction site. and the movie was called Killdozer, and I always thought that was a great name. I sort of had it in my back pocket since I was like in high school. And we started the band Killdozer, and sure enough, someone else had the same idea. Some other potheads in Wisconsin saw the same stupid movie and thought it was cool.
Now, people listening right now to CITR, FM 102, Cable 102, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, the Nardwuar Human Serviette Radio Show, and we're speaking here to Mike Edison, author of I Have Fun Everywhere I Go, might be going, wow, they got to open up for Ramones. But people also might be thinking, wow, Sharky's Machine on Shimmy Disc. Kramer, the legendary Kramer,
dude,
Shimmy Disc.
Douchebag, the legendary Kramer. How about the legendary douchebag and thief?
But the patchable penis, he did have some sort of aura behind him. A lot of people worshipped the Shimmy Disc empire, and you were part of it, Mike.
Yeah, some empire. The guy's an old fucking hippie. You know, I mean, the truth is, the good thing that I'll tell you what he did was good. He saw us playing at a bar and he said, hey, let's make a record. And he helped us connect the dots. It all happened very fast with Sharky's Machine because for us it was like an experiment. For me, I had been playing the drums in blues bands and garage bands, and I really wanted to do something a little a little artier, a little more avant-garde, but still sort of like have like the attack of like a hardcore thrash band. I was thinking somewhere between like the Misfits and the Bad Brains and Captain Beefheart. And we did it. And so I was playing in a band, playing in this bar one night, and honestly, the guys in my band didn't know how to play their instruments. I sort of just picked them up because they were willing and they were game, and they would play, you know, these things that I was sort of constructing. More like building models than writing songs, and it worked, you know. And I was lucky; I found a really good singer, this, you know, crazy psychotic cat that was my roommate in college. And he turned out to be a good singer, and Kramer saw us. He goes, "Let's make a record," and we're like, "All right, let's do that thing." And he put us in touch with somebody, said, "Hey, you guys want to come to Amsterdam and do a gig, and then we'll put you on tour in Holland and Germany." Like, okay. But at the end of the day, Kramer had his hands in a damn cookie jar. We would get paid. Well, we didn't get paid. The record company got paid. We never saw any of it. And he'd licensed our record to, like, all over the place. We never saw the dough. And then I found out every other band had the same experience. You know, for scapping a few bucks from us, we could have had a really nice thing going, you know, except he ripped us off and we're out of there. That guy's a psychotic pot addicted thief.
And this is Kramer Shimmy Disc, not the other Kramer, although the other Seinfeld Kramer, he has a connection to garage rock kind of too, because I think he was the stand-in double, well, actually, the singer of the garage rock band Speedball Baby, who I think has something to do with John Spencer. Wasn't he like the stand-in double for Kramer?
Oh, yeah, you know, Ron from Speedball Baby. I know those guys. Actually played with them a little bit. And Matt Verderay, who's the guitar player for Speedball Baby, is playing with John Spencer now in a band called Heavy Trash. And they're an unbelievably good, psychotic rockabilly band. And y'all should go out and pick up their records and check them out. I mean, they're making the records that the Cramps should have been making, because I love the Cramps. I'll tell you what. I mean, you tell me, boss, when's the last time they made a good record? No, never mind. I'll tell you. It was 30 years ago. You know, the day they got a bass player was the day that thing went south. But everybody should check out John Spencer's band, Heavy Trash, because they are the mighty ruling force in rockabilly today.
Well, Bikini Girls with Machine Guns is pretty good.
Ah, to me, you know, it reminded me of like when the Dead Kennedys did MTV Get Off the Air. They were just trying to fit too many damn words into a chorus of a song.
I guess I'm so mixed up that I usually just crank the treble anyway, so I don't really hear the bass, right? I'm not really into the bass, so I don't really even hear the bass, so it's never really bothered me too much.
Yeah, but the fuzz guitar had the bass. It had some weird low-frequency rumble, you know, that was like, it would disturb your brain, it would shake up your bowels. That's why Human Fly is so cool. When you listen to songs the Lord taught us, and you hear, like, TV Set, it's all about that fuzz guitar. How could you play TV Set with a bass? That's not what it's about. You know, how could you play like Mad Mad Daddy with a bass, or I Was a Teenage Werewolf, or Garbage Dumping, the great Charles Manson song covered by G.G. Allin. We used to do that all the time. And how do you play that with a bass? It doesn't make any sense.
Mike Edison, what about the rock and roll band The Mummies? I know they had an interesting sort of beef with Mike Mariconda from the Ronchans. Were you privy to any of that?
They wrote a song about him calling him a dick. I don't know exactly what happened, but I'll tell you what, Mariconda was pretty pissed off. But everybody else in the Ronchans, we thought it was funny.
Because people love The Mummies, and they just got recently flown to Spain to put on a festival. What's the deal, or to play a festival, what's the deal with Spain flying in bands? They always fly in the coolest bands to play gigs, and they flew you in, and you stayed there for a few years.
Yeah. We got to Spain, then I didn't leave. Spain was great, you know, especially then. We're going back. We'll be in Spain in April. We're playing some festival. The Ronchans, we actually have a new record out. It's called Ronchans Big Top, B-I-G-G-T-O-P-P, Big Top. And, Spain.
When you lived there, who did you play with? Like, NoFX always tell me stories when I've talked to them before about playing in Japan, and, like, No Doubt has to back up NoFX in Japan, because NoFX are bigger than No Doubt in Japan. I bet you'd like to see that gig, wouldn't you, Mike? No Doubt and NoFX. That'd probably be number one on your gigs to check out when you're in Japan. But did any of that sort of happen when you were in Spain with the Ronchans?
Well, I'll tell you, we always did real well in Spain. People like rock and roll in Spain. People like to move. People like to shake. People like to swing. It's a whole country filled with people who like to stay up all night and eating and drinking. They like their drugs, and they're really pretty fearless. in Spain.
Did you ever check out Canadian band Bum from Victoria when they were brought over to Spain?
Yeah, I knew those guys, actually. I saw them. Yeah, they were nice guys. I remember them playing some gigs.
Because they had kind of broken up, and then somebody in Spain offered to bring them over. I think Munster Records or somebody like that. And then they went over to Spain and played to huge audiences, which is just incredible. Like a band, you know, kind of broken up out of Victoria could go to Spain and then have an all-expense-paid trip, and then people would be totally into it, and into every word, too.
Yeah, those people are crazy in Spain, man. They really dig it. You gotta understand, Spain lived under a dictatorship, until the mid-70s. Birth control wasn't even legal in Spain until the late 70s. So they had their renaissance and their sexual revolution 10 years after we did in North America, you know? So it was crazy. So their real coming out party was in the early 80s in Madrid. There was a scene called La Movida, and that was what was happening then, what was like what was happening here in 67, you know, the Summer of Love, and then later in 1977, when punk rock came up. It didn't really happen there, you know, until the 80s. You know, I mean, imagine that. Imagine, like, living under a dictator for all those years. Imagine not being able to buy a condom for all those years.
That's interesting. I never really thought about that, and then it just all exploded when he left.
Yeah, and people are still, I mean, it's a very Catholic country, but it's still coming up. I mean, Mexico's a pretty wild place, too. One thing about Spain and, like, Mexico, a very Catholic country, you know, they say Mexico Libre. They say, you know, España Libre, free Spain, free Mexico. What that really means is we're free to do what we want. It means we don't really give a shit what our neighbor's doing. We're not looking in somebody's window. We don't care what you do in your bedroom. We don't care what you do in the bar. Just, you know, do it and have fun. It's about living. Free
Mike,
living.
Mike Edison, author of I Have Fun Everywhere I Go. You have a CD that comes with the book, don't you?
Well, the CD doesn't actually come with the book. Sorry to disappoint you kids, but yeah, you got to pay separately for it. But there's some stuff on the internet you can probably scap and download for free. I wrote this book. It's a memoir of my years working for sleazy magazines. You know, I was the publisher of High Times magazine, the Dope Rag, as my grandmother used to call it. And I used to work for Screw magazine here in New York, a legendary porn magazine. And I worked for Hustler and Penthouse and a million other girly magazines that no one's ever heard of. And it's my memoir of working for all these sleazy magazines in New York and for playing with Gigi Allen and the Ronch Hands and all the adventures we had. And when I wrote the book, at the same time, I decided to make a spoken word record with my friend John Spencer, who I'm a great fan of. We're terrific friends. We're actually neighbors and have been for a long time. And we decided to make this crazy spoken word record. So we got down with it, and sort of a throwback. I was into listening to Jack Kerouac records. You know, honestly, I was never a big Jack Kerouac fan. I don't really dig his books. I think they're kind of boring. And I have it on good authority. He was a bullshit beatnik. He voted for Eisenhower, if that means anything to all you kids in Vancouver. But I like listening to him read with bongo players and piano players behind him. So we decided to do it. Once John got involved, the guitars got real loud. The synthesizers got all sorts of psychedelic. And we made a record. It's also called I Have Fun Everywhere I Go. With my band, the Edison Rocket Train, behind us. And yeah, I think it kicks ass. It's a new way to tell stories.
The book is also subtitled Pro Wrestling, Porn, Pot, Rock and Roll. I mean, what else is there? Isn't that what everybody wants?
Yeah, you would think.
Drugs!
There are lots of drugs.
And I wanted to ask you about drugs, Mike Edison.
Ask me anything about drugs.
The Cocaine Habit Blues from 1927. What can you tell the people about the Cocaine Habit Blues from 1927?
You know, there's a video on me on YouTube doing that in a bookstore in Los Angeles. The old-fashioned Cocaine Habit Blues. Because I like my whiskey and I like my gin. The way I like cocaine, it's a goddamn sin. You know, back in the day, first of all, cocaine was legal up until about 1927. Don't forget, they put the Coke in the Coca-Cola before it was caffeine.
Have you ever tasted Coke in Coca-Cola?
No, but I tasted a little cocaine in all sorts of other environments. It sounds good, right? If they sold that stuff, man.
But like a vintage can of Coke you may have found, you know, around the High Times office. Anybody send in some vintage can of Coke or bottle of Coke that you were able to taste?
Yeah, as if those hypocrites in High Times. You know, half of that office was doing, you know, this, that, the other thing beyond the friendly hippie weed. But the official magazine policy, of course, is we don't do hard drugs. Yeah, that would have been all right. Sounds good, right?
The Cocaine Habit Blues, 1927, you mentioned as part of your book tour. Your book tour, I saw clips on the internet. It looks really interesting. When you did your book tour, wasn't this you reading? You had, like, a little band behind you.
Well,
and you were the band yourself, too.
Well, yeah, it depends. When we were on the West Coast, I couldn't bring the whole band because I have like five people, including John Spencer, in the full band. But I bring a drummer, and I have this contraption called the Interstellar Groove Machine, which is a keyboard and a theremin and a sequencer and all this kooky stuff. Hey, look, you ever been to a book reading before? They suck. A lot of people, just because you write a book doesn't mean you should be able to read a book or that you are able to read from your book. A lot of writers, they do what they do because they do it alone, inside, and they should never leave. Me, I don't feel that way. I feel I want to take my message to the people. I mean, I'm lucky because, you know, I'm playing a rock and roll band. I'm trying to get it out. I like leaving it up on stage. So when we decided to tour the book, we decided to terrorize people with the sound of the message.
How did that go? How did the tour go? You went on the West Coast. Like, you played Powell's in Portland.
Powell's was a good gig. That was one of the, that's a good place. I understand Portland's the most literate city in the United States. That was good. There were a lot of people, and I answered questions about professional wrestling for hours after the show. Powell's was good. And what we would do is we'd do these gigs in the bookstores, do the reading, and then afterward we'd go take it to a bar or nightclub and do a punk rock gig.
Who was drumming for you at that time?
Sweet Joey Valentine, my main man. Joey Valentine was the original Rocket Train drummer, and I recommend all you young people listening to this radio show go out and get a copy of Yes, Yes, Yes by the Edison Rocket Train. That was our first record. We got a new one coming out soon. It's only taken us 8 years to get it together, but yeah, we got a new one coming out, which John Spencer also produced.
When did you first meet John Spencer?
John and I used to travel in the same circles. It was weird. He was on Crypt Records also, labeled at the wrong time.
He was on Crypt later, though, because that's what I was curious about. He was like, you know, that Pussy Galore scene. How did the Pussy Galore scene integrate with the New York sleaze rock, scum rock scene, like the Reverb Motherfuckers? Remember those guys?
Sure, we did. We did a lot of gigs with those, them,
and,
too.
And the Ronchans, like, how did Pussy Galore go down with them? Because it was kind of separate, wasn't it? Like, well, Sonic Youth weren't really into the Sonics at that time. You know what I mean? Now they say they were, but
no,
it was totally separate. Lydia Lunch, how did Lydia Lunch mix with you guys and all that sort of stuff?
Well, I'll tell you what, the one guy in between all of it was my friend Wharton Tears, who ran a studio called Fun City in New York, and he had worked with Pussy Galore, and he had done a lot of Sonic Youth records. He'd worked with Lydia. He'd done a lot of No Wave records. He knew the guys in the Contortions and all these people. I always was a Pussy Galore fan. I always really liked them. I thought, you know, half of their stuff was just like, it just made me crazy. It was just so cool. The other half made me crazy because it was so obnoxious. I didn't know John when he was doing Pussy Galore, but I was a fan. We kept missing each other. That's when I was in Sharky's Machine, who had our own sort of artsy, you know, noisy kind of angle on things. And we kept missing each other. And I finally met John in Madrid, actually, when I just moved to Spain. And he was coming through town. And I went down to the sound check to introduce myself because we had some mutual friends. And we stayed friends. When I moved to New York, we ended up being neighbors.
So you're in Spain. When were you doing the wrestling thing? When were you down with the wrestling team?
Well, the wrestling team. The main event team. You make it sound like it's some like faggoty varsity wrestling team. Dude, we're talking about professional wrestling. Let me tell you something. If you can't hit a guy over the head with a chair, then it ain't wrestling. All right? That was my first job when I dropped out of college for the first time. I got this gig working for a professional wrestling magazine, and my boss was a big Hulk Hogan fan. You know, he was a good guy. He was the editor-in-chief. He liked to fly the flag, the red, white, and blue. He liked to talk about staying in school and not doing drugs. And frankly, he wasn't my kind of people. You know, I wasn't into this Hulk Hogan shtick. I liked the bad guys. I was into the Magnificent Morocco. I liked the Sheik, the Iron Sheik.
What can you tell the people about the Iron Sheik, Mike Edison? I've seen some videos of him and some interviews of him. Nowadays, like, he's still out there doing it, isn't he?
He's out of his mind. I think he's got a gig on the Howard Stern Show or something, but he is way out of his mind. Don't forget, he was a World Wrestling Federation champ. He lost it to Hulk Hogan. He was the guy who put Bob Backlund down, for all you older fans out there in the audience. Bob Backlund was the All-American boy, and he'd been the champion for years. And boy, you talk about twisted old fruits. I mean, he still thought he was a collegiate wrestler. He didn't want to break the rules. He wanted to be a good guy, and took the Iron Sheik from Tehran, Iran, to put him down. I love the Iron Sheik. You know, I root for the bad guys. You know, I see a cowboy movie, I root for the guys with the black hats every time.
Jimmy Hart, he has a rock and roll background, doesn't he? Because he was in a band, the Gentry's, Keep on Dancing.
That's right. That's right, Jimmy Hart. And he was the guy who, because he got into wrestling, he was in the Gentry's, that's right, they did Keep on Dancing, later covered by the Ramones. And Jerry Lawler was working in Elvis shtick. This is down in Memphis Wrestling, and Memphis Wrestling was a really, really sick thing going on down there. You should read the book called It Came from Memphis, which tells the story of Memphis Wrestling, especially Sputnik Monroe, who was a wrestler down there. Sputnik Monroe was this white cat, but he had all these black fans. He was a bad guy. And he would go to these black neighborhoods and talk to people and make these fans and say, I'm going to kick that white guy's ass, and helped integrate Memphis. Because he had so many black people come to see him fight in a very segregated town that they just had to, like, you know, take down the ropes and let everybody get along together. It's a beautiful story. When civil rights and professional wrestling meet.
Mike Edison, how many books / novels have you written? You've mentioned 28 novels that you've written, and what have they been about? Like, under what name did you write these novels?
Well, novels is being kind, but they are novels. I mean, they tell stories. They have beginning, middles, and ends, and they're all pornographic. It's the most unbelievable filth ever foisted upon mankind. This is a job I had. Right around the time I just started working for the wrestling magazines, and was trying to cut my teeth being a writer, and I got this job writing smut novels. You understand, this is a time before everyone had VHS players in their houses, you know, and pornography was, you know, existed on the printed page. So I'd write these books. Cindy's Brutal Ordeal was my first one. Cindy's Brutal Ordeal, an S&M.
Was that by Mike Edison?
They were all written by anonymous, believe it or not. These books are so filthy they didn't even merit, like, pseudonyms.
Now, are they super collectible? Can I find them anywhere? How many were printed?
I can't find them. I don't know how many they printed. I think they printed about 4,000 of each one. They look like regular paperback books, except they have really filthy illustrations on the cover. And the way it worked, and I talk about this in my book, I'll tell you how you can write your own porn novel and how this worked. Basically, it was run by the mafia here in New York, who ran, like, pornography distribution. And I would go to this place. It was like this little shop where they had a couple of these old-fashioned word processors, not like any, you know, Macs or Apples or PCs you see now. I mean, they were gigantic, you know? I mean, and it was all connected to this thing. It was about the size of a Zamboni machine, which people in Vancouver are well familiar with. And that spit out the typed pages on this glossy paper that could be reproduced. It was repro-proof, it was called, ready, you know, for a photographic printing process. And we just sit there and write pornography all day. So the guy would tell me, Mike, I need an S&M book. Cindy's Brutal Ordeal. Next day he'd say, Mike, I need a Young Virgins book. Call it Busting Susan's Cherry.
Now, how do you write porn, Mike Edison, author of I Have Fun Everywhere I Go? What are the keywords to write porn?
Just, you know, what are the keywords? How do you write porn? Just like I put on my pants, one leg at a time. You know, here's the way it goes. Books, porn books are just like regular books. And you can't think about writing pornography. You got to think about just writing. So you need a plot. You need a conflict and a resolution. So it's Little Miss Muffet sat in her tuffet. There's your premise. Eating her curds and whey. There's your what we call the rising action for all you lit students out there. Along came a spider and sat down beside her. There's your conflict, and scared Miss Muffet away. And that's the resolution. Now, in a porn book, it sort of goes like this. Susan was the class virgin, and she was hot. She was so smoking hot, you wouldn't believe it. And all the boys wanted Susan. That's your premise. Now, the conflict is, she ain't giving it up, though. That's the problem. She is guarding that cherry like it ain't nobody's business. But first we start with a few fumbling hand jobs, a few heavy petting sessions at the back of Zach's hot rod, and then one night, behind the barn, she gives it up. And then you know what happens? She can't get enough. That's the resolution. I mean, that spider could have, sat down and gone down on Miss Muffet, but it didn't really work that way. Miss Muffet split. Not so much with Susan.
One of the books you mentioned was called Cindy's Brutal Ideal. Did it have metal in it?
Yeah, that was my heavy metal book. That same thing. Cindy was a nice girl until the heavy metal band came to town to teach her about bar chords and Marshall stacks. Oh, and sadomasochism.
Were you able to slip any punk in any of your books at all?
Oh, yeah, all my friends were in those books back in the day. If you read them closely, you'll see references to just about every band that was playing around.
They must be totally rare, though, those books.
Yeah, I can't even find them. I look on eBay all the time. I wrote 28 of them. I think I have about 7 or 8 of them in the house.
Like, really expensive on eBay, because, like, in the 1960s, all those sort of smut porn novels, those are now have become totally collectible.
Yeah, I don't even know where to find them. You know, I really don't. I mean, it's
where were they sold?
They were sold on 42nd Street and Times Square, you know, in places like that, and whatever sort of red light district your town had, you know, and the peep shows and the massage parlors, because they sold literature. Don't forget, there were no videotapes.
So, wrestling, then we have porn, and then you get a publisher. How do you get a publisher, Mike Edison? How do you get a publisher? Because you got Macmillan. You got a publisher.
Yeah, Macmillan. I know, it's a literary publisher. Go figure. Well, the thing about that is, and I'll tell you, I turned down a lot of money from HarperCollins, offered me like unbelievable amounts of money for my book. But they saw porn, they saw pot, they saw wrestling. They said, great, we'll take pictures of you smoking dope with strippers. I was like, no, you won't. Because the idea is, look, I'm a writer. All I do is write. You know, I write and I play music. And it's supposed to be good. It's not, it wasn't a cheap trick. It wasn't, you know, a one-shot deal. I think if I'd been working in a bakery or a tire factory my whole life, I'd still be able to write a good book, because the story is in the telling. You know what I'm saying? You know, the story is in the telling. One of my very favorite books of all time is a book called Rivethead. It was a guy who worked on a GM assembly line, the General Motors assembly line, putting rivets into cars, building cars. And he wrote one of the greatest, most captivating books of all time. And I always figured, man, if a guy could write a great book about the most mundane job of all time, I could certainly write a great book about being a professional wrestler, about working for a pot magazine, about being a pornographer, about playing with Gigi Allen and the Ron Chans. And that's where it came down. And I was lucky I found an editor. I have, like, this big, like, highfalutin literary agent, but we found an editor over at Macmillan, Farrah Straus Giroux, who read my book and saw value in it. She saw beyond the pot smoke and beyond the pornography, beyond the broken glass. She saw that I could tell a story.
So you landed with Macmillan. Who did Macmillan turn down? Do you know if Macmillan turned anybody down?
They turn people down every day. I don't know.
Who are your authors that were your contemporaries on Macmillan? Who else is on Macmillan? Like, when your book came out, who
Macmillan.
Were you linked with? Anybody?
Say Macmillan. Goddamn. Saying advertising for Macmillan. Actually, Macmillan owns a bunch of different publishers. They got all corporate with me, too, at the end of the day. But I was published on an imprint called Faber & Faber, which is part of Farrah Straus Giroux, which is a really, really very, very cool imprint with a great history of printing you know, great literature, great American writers. But Macmillan, they're a big company. They have a lot of publishers. You know, I mean, Augustine Burroughs, you know, is my colleague. So is Eli Wiesel and Thomas Friedman. They publish a lot of stuff.
For Al the Tongue Goldstein, how aggressive was he? I once spoke to him, and he kept on saying to me, I'm not going to speak to you anymore until you put some ads up on the web advertising my magazine. Like, he was really aggressive, and then his secretaries would say the same thing. How aggressive was Al the Tongue Goldstein? Did you replace him? This I didn't quite understand. Did you replace Al the Tongue Goldstein? Did you actually work side by side with him from Screw Magazine?
Well, I worked with Al back in the day when I was a writer for Screw, and then Al just sort of drove his own magazine into the ground, and part of that was, you know, being aggressive in the wrong places and not being aggressive enough in the right places and being crushed by the internet and what have you. And some of the former art director of Screw, that's some partners, and they bought the business. I mean, Al was going belly up, it was bankrupt, and they called me and said, hey, do you want to be the editor? Which, of course, which is really a case of be careful of what you wish for, because you just might get it. Because once I got there, it was a job I'd always wanted. But, you know, I was trying to really bring a dinosaur back to life. It was really not going to happen unless they invested a lot of money into an internet presence, which they weren't worth it. I don't know if anybody's ever seen Screw Magazine. It was a weekly. Screw was a weekly tabloid. And that meant we reported on the news, like, as it was happening. It was not like a regular porn magazine. You know, we did 52 issues a year. And that was crazy. You know, we just rocked it and we rolled it. And we were so abusive to every politician, to every celebrity, to every hypocrite, every hack and fraud, whether it was the mayor of New York or the president of the United States. I mean, we just put their head in a toilet bowl. We did whatever we wanted because our advertisers were a bunch of whores. You know, it wasn't like we were going to lose the big Lexus account. It wasn't like, you know, Bacardi Rum was going to drop out if we offended their, you know, their clientele.
What was your interaction with Al Goldstein like?
Al's could be a very generous, unbelievably intelligent guy.
Was he ever aggressive at all when you were speaking to him?
Or, of course he's aggressive. He could also be a complete, like, insufferable fucking prick, too. Al's mentally ill, you know, and he's a minefield. So it depends on what day of the week it was, whether you're going to get good Al or bad Al. But I respect Al, you know. I mean, you know, here in the United States, we got a thing called the First Amendment, and that protects, among other things, freedom of speech. And there's still a bunch of humorless people who don't really quite get it and will sue you for printing things that are within you know, the purview of this First Amendment, that are protected speech. And Al wins these cases, and he is a hero to journalists. He gets a rap as a filthy pornographer. He is the original, the originator of the cliche of a big fat Jew pornographer, and I say that with great love, being a Jew pornographer myself. But Al's really a hero in the journalism business for opening doors. I mean, thanks to him for one thing, it's completely legal. I mean, it always was, but now no one will sue you for satirizing a corporate logo. Not only can you make fun of a politician or a celebrity or a public figure, you can make fun of a corporation.
And that's because of Al Goldstein.
Yeah, Pillsbury sued him. You know, Pillsbury, you know, makes, you know, the
Doughboy.
Yeah, he had a picture of the Pillsbury Doughboy screwing the Pillsbury Doughgirl, and they sued him. And he said, no, the Pillsbury Doughboy is fair game, just the same way Charlton Heston or Bill Clinton, you know, or Citigroup is, you know, Citibank, or, you know, and he won.
And check out Mike Edison on the web. Where exactly? That's rockettrain.com. Rockettrain.com, right?
Rockettrain.com, RockettRain, rockettrain.com, and just put my name, Mike Edison, in your Google machine, and you can find the Chronicaster, the legendary bong guitar video, and you can see me singing and dancing and all sorts of other crazy stuff. Hey, that bong guitar video, I think we're going to hit 200,000 views this week.
And it's pretty interesting, that guitar. You held on to it. You said you have to have patience, don't you, in publishing? You have to have patience. You had this amazing guitar, and you held on to it until the internet was able to have videos on the internet. You foresaw videos going on the internet, didn't you, Mike Edison?
Yes, I knew that was going to happen. You know, you got a bong guitar in your closet, and you say to yourself, what am I going to do with this damn thing? Everybody loves it. Everybody wants to see it. And you say, someday there will be YouTube. And cue the angelic music. And, yeah, YouTube's an awesome thing.
Could you describe the bong guitar a bit, just quickly, winding up here with Mike Edison?
Well, I think you should go on YouTube and check out bong guitar. You can Google my name or just Google
Have
bong
you done
guitar.
Any gigs with it?
You know, technically it's drug paraphernalia, so it's probably better not better to not take it out of the house. But it's a acrylic clear guitar with a hollow chamber, and the body fills up with smoky, and it plays. It's a great guitar. It's got some hot-wired pickups and locking tuners. It's a badass guitar. It really is. In fact, I have the non-smoking model as well, which I use all the time. But this guitar was used in a movie we made at High Times, and Tommy Chong smoked it in the movie. He had this scene where he smoked out of the guitar, and I kind of walked off the set with the guitar. I was one of the producers of the film. I didn't swipe it or anything. I was kind of responsible for getting the thing made, and that was my reward for being involved in a movie that really should have gone straight to YouTube anyway.
What's the name of the movie?
It's called High Times Potluck, but good luck finding it. it's not the worst movie ever made, but I don't know. It just was one of those things. It was typical High Times, you know, clusterfuck. Just too many cooks in the kitchen, and too many people wanting to be the star, and too many people, you know, arguing over every damn thing. I think Vancouver's probably a really good stoner town. You know, I mean, you guys have got it right up there. But in the High Times office in New York, they really defied any cliche of the mellow stoner. I mean, you never met a more backbiting bunch of people in your life. I mean, these were like the paranoid potheads. It was a bad place, man.
Have you seen Cannabis Culture magazine out of Vancouver, BC, Canada at all?
Yeah, of course. And they seem to be very progressive. They don't have like the brand name that High Times has. High Times was great when it started in the 70s. If you look back at those old issues, you had great writers. It was funny. It wasn't all about pot. It wasn't specifically a pot magazine. It was more about hedonism, which meant, you know, drugs, of course, and sex, and every other thing. And pot was a huge part of it, of course, but the centerfolds could also be not only just cannabis or hashish, but also cocaine. over the years it changed. It became more of a hippie thing. It really didn't. I mean, there was definitely a hippie culture involved, but it was more of really a radical left-wing culture, I'd like to think. In fact, High Times was the first national magazine in the United States to put the Sex Pistols on the cover.
What year was that?
1977.
Right then and there, ground zero.
Well, the guy who started the magazine, Tom Forsad, and I tell this whole story in my book, he saw punk rock as the next big youth movement. You know, he saw that as what was happening. Of course, the hippies who had sort of been running the magazine at that point, you know, cause, sure, it was acid heads and potheads and stuff, but he was a radical. He wasn't a flower power hippie. He was a, you know, more like the MC5 kind of hippie as opposed to the Grateful Dead kind of hippie.
Boy, I'm going to look for some back issues. I must admit, I always got High Times confused with Mother Jones.
No, back in the day, it was pretty radical.
And then I thought for some reason that Michael Moore was the editor of High Times, but he was involved with Mother Jones, I think. It got all mixed up for me. So thank you for setting the record straight, Mike Edison. That's what your book is for, isn't it? To set the record straight. To name names.
I name names. I take no prisoners. I kill them all.
You have fun everywhere you go. You're Mike Edison. And winding up here, Mike. Okay, we mentioned wrestling. We mentioned porn. We mentioned drugs. Back to the rock and roll for a second. I approached rock and roller Andrew W.K. from New York City, who has the song I Love New York City, and asked him about his weirdest New York club experience. And he said the weirdest club he ever went to in New York City, and you being from New York City, I want to ask you this too, was when he went to this club and he stepped into it and he wanted to go get a drink, and then he saw this little sign that said step up to the bar, and he stepped up to the bar, and then he realized he was stepping on a guy. A guy was underneath him, rolled in a carpet. He had a bundling and a crush fetish, and it was his fetish to hang out at a bar and have people stand on him without people knowing they were standing on him. Have you ever experienced something like that at all, Mike Edison? And what is the weirdest club you've been to in New York?
Yeah, I think I was at that bar, actually. A lot of weird people in New York City, you know? But, hey, New York City, Nueva York, Libre, free New York, right?
Has everybody really been to that bar?
Yeah, that bar or one just like it. Man, you know, the thing about New York, I got to tell you, though, it's dying. You know, that doesn't happen anymore. You know, in the late 70s and the 80s,
I think that still happens. I think that club, that particular club, is still going.
When I came of age in the early 80s, I mean, it was the Wild West here. Anything could happen. Now, I go to bars, all I see is a bunch of goddamn flat-screen TVs with a football game on them. It's not as crazy as it once was. There are hardly any places for rock bands to play. And there are too many damn rock bands, and they all suck. Except for my band, of course.
What about Handsome Dick Manitoba's club, Manitoba's? Because I know you helped him with the book.
Yeah.
What's his club like? People in Canada don't like Handsome Dick Manitoba. Because
like
he sued the band Manitoba and made them change their name to Caribou because he thought the band Manitoba was too much like him, the name.
Motherfucking Jew. Fucking Manitoba. Look, Richard Dick Manitoba, he's like my brother. But, that's show business for you, I guess. I don't know. He's a good guy. You know, we did the official punk rock book of lists together. Something else all you kids need to ask your parents to buy you next Christmas.
What does his club look like? Does it have flat screen TVs?
He does. Motherfucker does have one. He's a big baseball fan, Manitoba, and he had a big Super Bowl party. It's just a bar. It's a cool bar. It's kind of divey. It's got lots of punk rock on the jukebox. It's a good place. It's a good place to go. And
you edited the punk rock book of lists with him.
Yeah, that was good. That was a fun project. Right now I'm actually working on the heavy metal book of lists.
And also you're doing something with Sly Stone, too? Mike Edison and Sly Stone together?
I'm not doing anything with Sly Stone. I worked on a biography of Sly Stone. During the day, I'm a very mild-mannered rock and roll book editor.
And Levon Helm, a Canadian, kind of.
That's right. Canadian, kind of. At least from Arkansas, but all his friends were Canadian.
But he grew up in Canada. Come on, right, he grew up with Ronnie DeHawk Hawkins, right?
That's right. Well, hey, here's my plug for what I do during the day. I'm an editor at Backbeat Books, which is a very happening rock and roll book publisher. And, yes, we did the Sly Stone biography. We just did a great book called I Hate New Music, the Classic Rock Manifesto. We did the Punk Rock Book of Lists. And we got all sorts of cool stuff coming out. So keep an eye out for Backbeat Books and I Hate New Music. It's an awesome book. And, of course, the Punk Rock Book of Lists, No Home Should Be Without It.
Well, Mike Edison, anything else? else you want to add to the people out there at all?
Well, I love you Canadians, and I love the people of Vancouver. You know I do. That is true. I think Vancouver is a definitely swinging city, and hopefully you guys will just keep at it. I hope to be there soon enough. Maybe I'll be reading or doing a gig or something like that. I hope everybody goes out and checks out my book, I Have Fun Everywhere I Go, and visits me on the internet at rockettrain.com, and I'll see you soon. We'll get together and smoke a big fatty.
Why should people care about I Have Fun Everywhere I Go and Mike Edison? Mike Edison, why should people care?
Well, at an hour into this conversation, now you ask the tough question. Why should people care? You know, they shouldn't care. You know, they just don't have to care. It's not about caring. It is about having fun. This is a positive message book. You know, it's about not looking back. I don't regret the things I've done. I regret the things I haven't done, but I'll get around to them, you know? I mean, that's what this book is about. This book is not an apology. It's not an Oprah moment. It's not, I got stoned and now I regret it. It's not a I got stoned and now I got straight story. This is a rock and roll book, and I don't know whether you should care or not, but hopefully you can laugh with me.
And Mike, right now we're going to cut to some selections from the CD from your book, and what can you tell the people about what we're going to hear? Pornography Part 1. Maybe you can give a warning to listeners. If anybody's easily offended, they should tune out right now, right? Or actually, they've been listening for a while. I guess they've been offended for an hour, but coming up right now could be some potentially offensive material. Right, Mike?
Yeah, well, I'm not safe for work, definitely. But, hey, this is my story, man. I lived it, and I survived to tell the tale. So, dig it. Hope everybody can have fun with me.
Pornography Part 1, The Warlord, Gigi Allen Died Last Night, Space Bob, Jews for Jesus, Talking Main Event Magazine Blues, and Aussie High Times, and me being Mike.
Yeah, Ozzy, you know, stole my pot.
And what could be worse than that if somebody steals your pot? Nothing, right? That's it.
Well, see, let me tell you something. Ozzy stole my pot. If he had asked, I would have given it to him. You know, fucking Ozzy. What a loser. I say that. I'm the guy, you know, peddling my book and talking about Ozzy Osbourne, but still, he did steal my pot.
Well, thanks so much, Mike. Keep on rocking in the free world and doot. Doodaloo doo.
Doop doom. Thank you.